This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the Black is Back Coalition holds a national conference in Chicago under the theme, The Ballot and the Bullet. Mumia Abu-Jamal speaks to the revolutionary journalism of France Fanon, and the daughter of a political assassination victim challenges the dictatorship in Rwanda. But first, the United States has embedded itself in Syrian territory after 6 years of arming Islamic jihadist fighters to overthrow that government. Russia is also in Syria, but that's at the request of the recognized Syrian government. There is no legal justification for the U.S. presence in Syria, according to Dr. Francis Boyle, the professor of international law at the University of Illinois.
The United States government has absolutely no right to be in Syria. It's clearly illegal under the terms of the United Nations Charter. It's a Nuremberg crime against peace, what is going on here. And it also violates the War Powers Clause of the United States Constitution and also the War Powers Resolution of 1973. So, you know, this whole thing is truly Orwellian by Trump. And I would say you have to understand it was Obama who started it. So Trump's just carrying on and exacerbating the long-term agenda here has always been to overthrow the Assad government and try to put a U.S. puppet in his place. And that was initiated by Obama, and Trump is just moving on to the next stage.
It seems that the United States thinks all it has to do is invoke ISIS, and that gives them a right to go anywhere and do anything. But there was no ISIS when President Obama first began to subvert the government of Syria.
That's correct. I mean, ISIS is just a boogeyman that we use as a pretext, certainly here in the United States, for domestic public opinion purposes, to justify illegal, unconstitutional U.S. military interventions abroad for strategic and economic reasons, and in particular, to steal all the oil and gas we possibly can, sitting under the lands owned, occupied by Muslim people of color around the world. Look at Libya, Iraq. The list goes on. Somalia has a lot of oil. South Sudan, when we amputated South Sudan. Syria is in a strategic location there for oil pipelines. The whole Persian Gulf, we treat as our lake, this current bullying up on Qatar. So it goes. It's been that way since September 11, 2001, when this bogus war on terrorism, now first it was Al-Qaeda, now it's ISIS, has simply been used as a pretext for the United States to go out and steal oil and gas from under lands owned and occupied by Muslims of color.
Hawaii Congressperson Tulsi Gabbard has a bill called the Stop Arming Terrorists Act, but it's only gotten 12 or 13 co-sponsors.
Right, because it's well known we are arming terrorists, certainly in Syria. There's no question all about it. So, of course, Congress isn't going to vote for this act because it would be criminalizing what the Pentagon and the CIA are doing and have been doing for quite some time. So I applaud the legislation, but when we're already arming, equipping, supplying terrorists and, you know, have been doing this for quite some time, we did the exact same thing in Libya, too, under the great Obama, who was behind me at Harvard Law School and exterminated 50,000 Libyans and destroyed Libya as a state. It's now total chaos. Syria is, too. Obama and Clinton did the exact same thing to Syria as well. There's not much left of Syria, I'm afraid to say.
During the campaign, at least for a little while, Donald Trump was behaving as if he wanted to at least curtail regime change policies of the United States. But back in April, he got into high gear with an assault against a Syrian air base that he claimed was justified because of a sarin gas attack, an attack that was attributed to the Syrians, but there's been no proof at all.
Well, that's right. And Seymour Hersh, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, just published an expose debunking all those claims in Die Welt. So I would encourage you to read it. But as for lying in campaigns, well, look, Obama was even a bigger liar, Glenn. You recall these promises Obama made during his campaign. As I said, he was behind me at Harvard Law School. We even had the same jurisprudence teacher, Roberto Unger, who would later publicly call Obama, quote, a disaster, unquote. But if you read all these statements that are coming out of the Obama campaign on international law, human rights, the United States Constitution, which I did read, they were impeccable. There was nothing wrong at all with any of them. Once he got in there, he was just as bad as Bush Jr. He was even worse. You know, Bush Jr. never arrogated to himself some alleged right to murder United States citizens, which Obama and his henchmen and henchwomen have done. So I think actually Obama was a bigger liar in his campaigns than Trump. And Trump's got in there and it appears that it's going to be business as usual. I thought that if Clinton had been elected president on November 8th, we'd be at war with Russia today. So far, we're not, although, as you pointed out in your introductory comment, we were very close to war this week in Syria. And what happened here, I think, these allegations of sarin use by Syria are total baloney. But in any event, it appears that Russia made it very clear that they were going to defend President Assad. And the Pentagon then told Trump that they were not interested in going to war with Russia in Syria. And that is why then you had Secretary of Defense Mad Dog Mattis get up there and say that Assad had backed down. Where, of course, who backed down was Trump. I think the Pentagon just made it clear they weren't willing to go to war with Syria. The same thing happened to Obama. Obama was going to bomb Syria on these totally bogus allegations that Syria had been behind the chemical weapons attack at Ghouta. At the time, I even made interviews saying this was total baloney based on evidence in the public record at that time. And eventually, again, Seymour Martin Hersh came out with an expose that debunked all that was published in the London Review of Books. And what happened there was that Russia had established a picket line of ships, warships, right off the coast of Syria, making it clear that Obama launched a campaign of cruise missiles and bombers from the Mediterranean into Syria, they were going to defend Syria. And at that point, someone from the Pentagon went over to the White House, it actually might have been Mattis, and told Obama, the Joint Chiefs, that we're not interested in a war with Russia over Syria. So Obama backed down. So there we are. But it's an extremely dangerous situation over there. I still have not read that the so-called deconfliction agreements have been formally reestablished between the two sides. And the threat by the Russians to shoot down, well, to target planes west of the Euphrates River still stands. So it's a very dangerous situation, although I breathed a little easier after Mattis got up there and said that apparently they were going to back down on the latest threat.
Now, the question of is the tail wagging the dog becomes rather complex. Some folks think that the jihadists can stage whatever kind of chemical attack they feel like and that it will be then ascribed to the Syrians. But the Seymour Hersh article claims that the United States knew full well that the Russians were using a conventional smart bomb to attack a meeting of high-level jihadists, and basically told a lie of whole cloth about it being a sarin bomb, which would indicate that the U.S. doesn't need jihadist provocations to make up these tales about the Syrians.
That's perfectly correct, Glenn. They can manufacture pretexts for wars whenever they want to. You know, as for the sarin claims, look, I drafted the U.S. domestic implementing legislation for the Biological Weapons Convention, known as the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989, that was passed unanimously by both houses of Congress and signed into law by President Bush Sr. If this had been sarin, everyone would have been dead. There wouldn't have been these pictures of babies and old people gasping for breath and things of that nature. So it's total propaganda, and we can turn it on and turn it off whenever we want to. That's perfectly correct, Glenn. And, you know, these jihadis, they work for us. We've armed them, equipped them, supplied them, trained them, and paid for them.
As a professor of international law, I guess we would like you to tell us what a formula for peace in Syria would begin with.
Well, the United States government has to order all its terrorist jihadis to stand down. That would be the first objective here, which, of course, the United States government is not going to do and has not done, because they still want to overthrow the Assad government and put a puppet in place. And actually, even worse than that, maybe if you go back to after 9/11, 2001, Wolfowitz, the deputy secretary of defense, who studied international relations at the University of Chicago the same time I did, publicly came out and said the United States government is going to get into the business of destroying states. And that's exactly what we did. We destroyed Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Sudan, Somalia. You can go right down the list. And as further confirmation of this, NATO General Wesley Clark was in the Pentagon right after 9/11, 2001. And they told him that, quote, this is from his memoirs, there would be a five-year campaign plan. Quote, there were a total of seven countries, beginning with Iraq, then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Iran, Somalia, and Sudan, unquote, that they were going to take out. So just look at the list. They've taken out Iraq. Syria was on the list. Libya, Somalia, Sudan. Lebanon has been completely discombobulated. And Iran is under threat right now as we speak. But Syria was on the list right away. And remember, Wolfowitz, we go way back, he's a diehard Zionist neocon, and they've been against Syria from the beginning. And notice all the states on this list were Muslim, every one of them. And so what we've seen for many years now are these diehard Zionist neocons determining U.S. foreign policy towards Arab and Muslim states of color. And let me be quite frank here. These diehard neocon Zionists are either Jewish or Christian, right? So this is really a clash of civilizations here between Jewish and Christian, alleged Jewish, alleged Christian, diehard neocon Zionists, and they're white Judeo-Christian diehard neocon Zionists against Muslims of color to destroy them and to steal their oil and gas. And again, don't take my word for it. Wolfowitz himself admitted that. And this was confirmed by General Clark in his memoirs, Winning Modern Wars, page 130. You can read it yourself. It's all there. So that's their agenda, Glenn.
So peace in Syria and elsewhere in the world depends upon the U.S. abandoning its longstanding imperial policies.
That's correct. And I would also say it's a bigoted and racist agenda against Muslims of color. Yes. But what else is new about that? when it comes to U.S. imperialism has always been racist. We have always sided around the world with lighter skinned people against darker skinned people across the board. I mean, this goes all the way back to the great black slave rebellion in Haiti, led by Toussaint Louverture and his people against Napoleon to set up the Second Republic in the Western Hemisphere after the United States. And our president, Thomas Jefferson, sided with Napoleon. So this has been a consistent factor in American foreign policy. We always side with lighter-skinned people against darker-skinned people. And now, since the discovery of all the oil and gas there under the Muslim world, you see all the bigotry and racism and Islamophobia here in America. You need propaganda to support an imperialist war, and that's what we have. The Nazis had the Jews, and we have the Muslims. It's that simple. And remember, Muslims of color here. You have a white racist Judeo-Christian elite here in America waging a bigoted and racist war against Muslims of color to steal their oil and gas. And that's been going on for quite some time, Glenn.
That was Dr. Francis Boyle at the University of Illinois in Champaign. The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations will hold a national conference in Chicago, August 12th and 13th. The theme of the gathering is The Ballot and the Bullet, War and Peace in the Era of Donald Trump. We spoke with Black is Back Chairman Omali Yeshitela and asked, what's so different about the Donald Trump era?
I think everything is different about the era of Donald Trump. I think Donald Trump, however, is symptomatic of a severe crisis, a deep and profound crisis of a whole social system of capitalism that's born of slavery and born of colonialism and world domination. And right now, that system is ripping apart at the seams, that more and more people around the world are fighting back, resisting, and it is responsible for economic and political crises all over the world and also inside this country. It's an extraordinary moment where Trump is also responsible for trying to take especially American foreign policy into new directions that threatens the established trajectory that had been in existence at least since the 1940s. It is creating disarray among the rulers in this country, creating dissension between rulers of this country and the establishment and other places around the world. It is threatening an entire rearrangement of the geopolitical arena. And so it is an extraordinary moment of increasingly fraught with the possibility of world war, war with major powers such as Russia and China. It is an extraordinary period.
Well, we are associating those threats of world war with Donald Trump since he's the guy in charge now. But were those threats not as serious previous to his rise?
I don't necessarily believe the threats were less serious. I think what is complicating things for the rulers in this country and around the world is some uncertainty about where American policy is going. There's uncertainty about this relationship between the U.S. and Russia now as a consequence of Trump's election. That was something that was assumed to have been settled. Most of the established ruling class in this country had been moving toward encircling Russia and dominating that area of the world. And now Trump has apparently at least waffle from time to time on the question of whether that's going to occur or not. I think that's a new kind of reality. It threatens a kind of uncertainty. It promises an uncertainty. And I think that's problematic for everybody. The fact is, Trump is threatening the possibility of a first strike against Korea. The point is not whether he's bluffing or not. He may be bluffing, but when he says that, when he hints of a possible first strike against Korea or military option against Korea, certainly what it does is push the Koreans closer to a greater defensive posture. So I think that's problematic. I think there are a lot of questions out there today, not because Trump is any more of a warmonger, for example, than Obama or Bush before him, or even Clinton, who lost the election, but I do think that there is an uncertainty that's been added to the situation that even permits a greater possibility of an unintended confrontation between the U.S. and some other powers.
Despite these escalating war tensions, there's not much of an anti-war movement here in the United States on the white side or the black side. But the Black Is Back Coalition has taken firm positions on war and peace.
Yeah, I think that the Black Is Back Coalition that put forth our National Black Political Agenda for Self-Determination deal with the question of war and peace. And I think that from the very inception that we have done that. I mean, that's why we are the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace and Reparations, Peace and Reparations. And I think that the combination of social justice, peace and reparation places the issue of peace in a different context than it has usually been conveyed inside this country and through most of Europe. And I think one of the outstanding factors of the coalition is that we have always associated the issue of peace with the question of victory against imperialism. Our principles of unity all stand in opposition to imperialist aggression, all stand in opposition to imperialist occupation, all stand in opposition to colonialism, etc. And that means it stands in opposition to the existing imperialist order. So there's nothing unusual about our stance, except that it is unusual in the context of what has passed as a peace movement, because too much of the peace movement has refused to recognize the war that's being made in arenas other than those which have been defined by the rulers. So if the U.S. government declares or acts in a warlike manner against people in Afghanistan, Iraq, other places, Palestine, we can recognize that. But the same U.S. government can talk about sticking up walls to reinforce the theft of Mexican territory and the inability of Mexican people to enter into this country, and there's no discussion about whether or not that's some violation of peace. The same thing with African people in this country, with children being gunned down in playgrounds and other attacks being made on us, there's no discussion of a violation of peace. And the reality is that the indigenous people who live in concentration camps in this country up to now and who face all kinds of aggression on a regular basis, concentration camps called Indian Reservation, that reality has not required an issue of war and peace, except for our coalition, which has initiated a process 8 years ago of contextualizing all of these efforts that's being made against colonizing and oppressed peoples around the world. So I think that's one of the things that distinguishes what the coalition has done, as well as the 19-point platform that stems from our National Black Political Agenda for Self-Determination.
The Black Is Back Coalition is holding its national conference in Chicago on August 12th and 13th. That's the first time it's moving that conference off of the East Coast.
Yeah, and I'm really excited about that because the Black Is Back Coalition has membership in the Midwest and certainly in Chicago. And one of the outstanding members of the steering committee, Brother Cam Howard from Encobra, the Amos T. Wilson Foundation, been established there for a very long time. And so that's going to be helpful. And I think it's really important because there are people throughout the Midwest, St. Louis, parts of Ohio, Detroit, the Michigan, et cetera. And I'm hoping that we can reach some of those people in the Midwest as well, because there are a lot of issues that attack us in those areas as a community. And we need to be functioning in a fashion that gives us also an opportunity to address some of the questions particular to that Midwest region. And not the least of them, of course, is the question of education. You're talking about Barack Hussein Obama's hometown, where we've seen 54 schools closed in African communities. We've seen police having some special station where they have taken Africans and other people and tortured them and beaten confessions out of them. That's off the books, more or less. And that kind of stuff needs to be brought to the surface in a way that it has not been effectively done, certainly within our communities. This gives us an opportunity to address some of those questions.
The theme of that conference is the ballot and the bullet. There was a famous speech by Malcolm X, of course, that was titled The Ballot or the Bullet.
Yeah. And I think that it's really interesting because Malcolm made that speech. Well, he made this speech several different times in 1963, and the one that's most remembered is one that he's made, I think, in 1964. and it was made in the Midwest. I think it might have been in Detroit where that presentation was made, that the one that most people are familiar with. And at that time, Malcolm was challenging the whole black movement, particularly as it was dominated by pacifists and people who were determined that we had to work within the system and in the face of the terror being waged against African people for simply trying to vote. And Malcolm was challenging both the marriage to the system and the position of nonviolence. And he raised real serious criticisms about that and said that it's got to be the ballot of the bullet, freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody. And it became an incredibly important presentation and actually informed the political development of a lot of people, including myself. And now we find ourselves in a situation that's not absolutely dissimilar, where there are people who wedded to the system in a certain way and see the electoral process as the only thing, only way that we can go. And I think what the coalition has done, the Black is Black Coalition for Social Justice, Peace and Reparation, what it has done is saying that we can bring the movement, the struggle for freedom, for liberation of our people, the anti-imperialist struggle into the electoral arena. That up until now, this has been an arena that's been dominated by pacifists, but dominated by people who were attached to the Democratic Party primarily and didn't plan to go any place other than that. And now the coalition is saying that we don't just have to be locked into electoral process, but we can take the struggle that Malcolm was talking about, that the Black Panther Party of the 60s was talking about, that Joe Moore and many other groups and personalities were talking about. We can take these struggles straight into the electoral political arena and then force these issues that have been absent from the electoral process. I mean, as much as Black people like to bring out what they characterize as iconic figures like John Lewis from the Civil Rights Movement, et cetera, the reality is that none of them, Lewis nor the others, have raised the critical questions about our communities, about police murder, about reparations and various other and violence that the United States is perpetrating against everybody around the world. We can do that. And so we're invading the electoral process and taking the revolutionary message with us into that process. So we say the ballot and the bullet. And we're also saying that in our 19-point statement of for self-determination that's come from the Black is Black Coalition, we're also saying that Black people have a right and a responsibility for self-defense and for armed self-defense against people who are trying to murder us, whether we're talking about arms of the state or ordinary white people who invade our churches and kill people while they are involved in religious services. So it's a new era, and I think that the coalition is responding to this era with this call. And also, as you know, Ajamu Baraka, who ran for vice presidential candidate on the Green Party ticket, is also involved in organizing Black Alliance for Peace, and he will be presenting from that organization at our conference as well with some suggestions and proposals dealing with this question of war and peace, because it is a critical issue at this time, and it grows more serious every day. And our situation as Black people becomes extremely problematic unless we are organized and prepared to deal with this question. And from my perspective, Glenn, ours has to be a defeatist position when it comes to the question of war and the possibility of war. What is going to be the position of African people in this country should America somehow find itself in armed conflict with Russia, armed conflict with Korea, armed conflict with China, any other body? That's a question that I think we need to put out on the agenda. And I believe, again, that our position has to be obviously for peace, but it's a defeatist position because we cannot support any imperialist agenda that's coming from America. And it doesn't matter that it is Trump, but we say the era of Trump because Trump is the guy in the White House at this moment.
So part of the challenge is to say, which side are you on in this battle against imperialism?
Which side are you on? And that's the critical question, because that's a question that none of the politicians has had to answer since the United States government successfully murdered people like Malcolm and Panthers and Jomo people and arrested revolutionaries around this country. They haven't had to answer the question, which side are you on? And they've created this false right and false left. And now you can be a Barack Hussein Obama or some other Democrat and be characterized as the left. And the only reason that can happen is because they've murdered and arrested and isolated much of what would be called a genuine revolutionary alternative to the Democratic Party. So which side are you on is the fundamental question that has to be addressed today.
Is there any promise, any worthwhile effort connected to working with established Democrats?
I mean, there may be, but the thing that gives it significance and makes the effort worthwhile is that the people are able now to approach the Democrats, the Republicans, the Greens, or anybody else with our own national black political agenda for self-determination. We have this, and this becomes the measuring stick that we use to gauge our relationship or any relationship that we have with any other force. And the thing that's so important about this coming from the Black is Black Coalition is that it takes the question of supporting this or not supporting that away from some individual position, because each of us can come up with why we are serving the people, serving the revolution based on our own separate definition of that reality. But now we come up with through the coalition with a very important democratic process of saying this is the agenda, this is the national black political agenda for self-determination, and this should be what we use to measure our relationship with any of these guys. And so I think in terms of the short-term tactical kinds of arrangements that we can talk to a Democrat, we can talk to a Green, we can talk to anybody based on what relationship they are willing to have with this agenda that comes from our community.
Has the coalition been speaking to other organizations that are outside of the coalition about the details of this national black political agenda and see if there is commonality?
I think that up to now, the most serious discussion has been with Ajmal Baraka and the work that he's doing. And the fact that's why we're inviting him to participate to some extent in this conference. I know that there are some people who are parts of the coalition, comrades Ralph Pointer and Betty Davis out of the New York area, that have been talking to people in the Midwest, some people who are associated with teachers' unions and have been trying to do some work and other kinds of work around political prisoners. I know that there's been that kind of outreach from certain sectors of the coalition. That's what I am most informed about, the things that I just mentioned.
So how is the work progressing as we move towards August 12th and 13th?
I think the work is progressing very well, and I am excited about it. I know the people who are in Chicago are excited about it, and I know people are mobilizing in different places, New York, Florida, Alabama, Texas, and various other places. I know there's mobilization that's happening, and people are putting it out, and I think that's the biggest question that we're confronted with now, getting the word out, developing a program for the 12th and the 13th that will allow us to maximize content within the limited time that you have in 2 days at Chicago State University. But I think things are going well. I do think that it's important for us to continue to reach out and try and win more participation. I think that's an ongoing process that we're involved in.
Omali Yeshitela, chairman of the Black is Back Coalition. The nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, was a radio journalist before he was locked up in the death of a Philadelphia policeman. In an essay for Prison Radio, Abu-Jamal speaks of Frantz Fanon, the revolutionary journalist.
Those who have studied the global black revolution of the 20th century have had to read the masterwork of Frantz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth, which was known as the Handbook of the Black Revolution, from Accra in Ghana to Oakland in California. This work, as much a psychological study as a diagnosis of the nature of French colonialism in Algeria, gave militants tremendous insights into the nature of imperialism and how resistance exploded against it. Former Black Panther leader Kathleen Neal Cleaver has written that Fanon's influence on black revolutionaries in the U.S. was profound. But before he published The Wretched of the Earth, he wrote a remarkable series of articles anonymously for the Algerian revolutionary journal El Mujahid from September 1957 to January 1960. El Mujahid's attacks on the French political and military colonial officials is unusually sharp and focused, reflecting Fanon's unique psychological and ideological insights into the Algerian and African struggles against imperialism. Al-Mujahid is an Arabic term meaning one who wages jihad or struggle. And here, one sees Fana in a potent war of words against the foreign occupation of Algeria. But Fana was far more than a word warrior. In his 1964 work, Toward the African Revolution, we find Fana, the critic, the political analyst, the Africanist, the internationalist, the Marxist, and the anti-imperialist. In his El Mujahid articles, Fana anonymously gives voice to the FLN, French Front Libération Nationale, English National Liberation Front, and ridicules French efforts to tie the FLN to raids, killings, and massacres, condemns Arab and African collaborators, and dissects how French forces use torture to intimidate the Algerian resistance. Fanon writes, "Torture in Algeria is not an accident or an error or a fault. Colonialism cannot be understood without the possibility of torturing, of violating, or of massacring." Fanon was a revolutionary journalist, or perhaps more clearly, a revolutionary who also worked as a journalist. His heart was with all anti-imperialist, revolutionary, and national liberation movements. His heart was with rebel friends like Nkrumah of Ghana and Lumumba of Congo. His heart was with what he called the wretched of the earth, the world's dispossessed.
Political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. Diane Wigara, the 35-year-old daughter of a businessman believed to have been assassinated by the regime of Paul Kagame in Rwanda, is persevering in her presidential bid. People that challenge dictator Paul Kagame most often wind up dead, in prison, or in exile. David Himbara is a journalist who fled Rwanda to avoid assassination. Himbara says Diane Wigara has given Rwandans hope. He appeared on Phil Taylor's radio program, Unusual Sources, in Toronto, Canada.
First of all, I have to say that regardless of the outcome of the election, Diane Wigara has already won. What do I mean by that? Here is a country where no one dares speak about any issue. This is a country that has been blocking people coming to participate in the election, making sure that there is only one man standing up, standing for the election. Then out of the blue, here comes Diane Wigara, calm and collected, a 35-year-old human rights activist, who announces that she's going to run for presidency. That is absolutely a shock to everyone, especially to the system.
We were speaking to David Himbara, and he knows whereof he speaks because international police organizations have reported accurately that his own life was threatened. You have to be one of the people who can testify how courageous this young woman is.
Yes, of course I was there. I had fled from Rwanda to South Africa, then I had to flee from South Africa to Canada. As I said, this is a totalitarian regime that has been making sure that no one else but the incumbent, Paul Kagame, competes basically against himself.
People who've spoken up and people who said they wanted to be candidates or tried to form parties have been found dead. The Green Party lost several leaders. Victoire Ingabire remains in prison, and all she did was say she wanted to form a party. But we should say that Diane Wigara, she has an interesting history. Her father was at once a very prominent man in Rwanda, and he died under suspicious circumstances. Tell us who he is, who was.
Yeah, here again is something very interesting. Diane Wigara's dad, Arsène Paul Wigara, was killed 2 years ago in a mysterious auto accident, but the family disputed the official version. The family, again, really did something unusual. They openly challenged the government to account. Normally in Rwanda, as you just said, when something happens to somebody, people accept and keep quiet, whether they're in prison or disappeared or dead, people just accept and move on. But the Rigara family said, no, this man was assassinated. And how did the government respond? It responded actually by demolishing the Rigara Hotel in Kigali.
Demolished it?
Yes, a hotel, claiming that he never had any license to build it. So usually the response of this government when it's challenged is to come to hammer the family or whoever into silence. But after demolishing the hotel, now then the Rigara daughter said, I'm coming for you. I'm going to challenge you for the presidency because you're not a good leader.
One of the words she chose, which I liked because it isn't often used in politics, but she says they're mediocre people.
Well, she said, you know, this is what happened. After she announced that she was going to run for presidency, the regime panicked. And then they put photoshopped photographs of this young woman naked.
Yes, this is sort of an old trick in Rwandan politics, to try to shame people.
But in this case, it backfired. Because, you see, she didn't give up. She said, I'm so disappointed. I thought I was running against real serious people. But actually, I'm so disappointed. They're so mediocre. She said something else. She said, look, I thought we were going to play like a real soccer game with the referee according to the rules. But you see, these are just amateurs.
And there's two things we need to know about, I think. One is, I'm receiving speculation that they're not going to allow her to be on the ballot. They will think of a trick. And then the second thing I noticed when I tried to do preparation for today to talk to you, David Himbara, is that it's like a blackout. But could be that there's quite a bit of discussion. But certainly the media here is not picking this up or reporting. Maybe they're startled or don't want to think about it. Is she going to be allowed to run, do you think?
Definitely. The regime will try all sorts of tricks to make sure that she doesn't run. But so far, she says that she has met all the requirements. She has 600 signatures collected from all districts in Rwanda. So far, so good. And I think that the regime was surprised. You see, normally what the regime does, it preempts people before things go too far. But she played a smart game, and she's now she's known. Regional media, the other day, the East African newspapers have picked up the story. The ambassadors in Rwanda, U.S., Germany, the European Union, have voiced their concern regarding electoral regulation, really challenging the government to stand up to its own laws, allowing for, like, Diane to compete. So far, so good. She says all is in order. The election is the 4th of August.
Let's go back to her father. He had been a prominent supporter of the Kagame government, but he was saying or doing something, which at the time that he mysteriously died. Are we to understand that there might be a serious division of opinion within the ruling circles of Rwanda right now?
Yeah. Basically, what you have in Rwanda there, you have the government of Kagame comprised mainly of people who came from Uganda, who led the struggle from Uganda. But the people like Rwigara were Tutsi from Rwanda, who were originally from Rwanda. And a man like Rwigara took serious risks to be one of the financiers of RPF, and he was doing that from within Rwanda, really taking a risk. But now, people like Rwigara, business, successful businessmen in the previous regime, have been targeted by the RPF regime. Some of them have fled. Rwigara, before his death, he was resisting this forced share between his business and the official businesses of RPF. Most businesses are forced to contribute. But he resisted. He says, no, look, I supported you when there was a struggle, but now this is a mature economy. Now it's about a private enterprise. I'm not going to play games. And then, of course, we know what happened.
Yeah. Well, by the way, we're speaking to David Himbara, and it's in your writings that you point out that he and others, I suppose, ran into a political organization that turned out also to be an economic monopoly. My understanding from reading your book is that Kagame thinks that if you have a business that's doing well, he can take that for himself.
Yeah, the regime has this. The Crystal Ventures is the conglomerate that controls most businesses in Rwanda. So really, any businesses that pose competition to Crystal Venture had some difficulty from the government. And Rigara was resisting to play along with any kind of association with the Crystal Ventures.
And in coming back to the daughter, and just to conclude, she, no doubt, the group that her father represented, they would be looking upon her with some favor, hoping to open up the economy to other people than Mr. Kagame, right?
I think all the Rwandans, I would say, really most Rwandans are looking up. She has done something extraordinary. People in Rwanda, but even in diaspora, are afraid of the government. Because even out here, if you say something critical, then your own family ends up in trouble in Rwanda. Basically, the population is hijacked. But here is a woman who said, no, I'm actually tired of fear, of hiding under bed to express my views, to talk about repression in this country, to talk about poverty. He says, no, enough is enough. I'm going to talk. So she has really given people courage.
That was David Himbara, a Rwandan writer and political exile, speaking with Phil Taylor on CIUT Radio, Toronto. WBAI-FM Radio in New York City is being sued by the Empire State Building, from whose towers it has been broadcasting since 1965. But the Empire State Building management claims WBAI owes it more than $2 million in back rent. The suit threatens not only WBAI, but other Pacifica stations in Texas and California, according to WBAI Interim Executive Director Bill Crossier.
Yes, it's pretty scary. And, I mean, Pacifica is all one legal entity, so they're suing Pacifica. WBAI, of course, is an important part of Pacifica, but they're suing us for over $2 million. And the lease was signed in 2005. It was renewed in 2005. And it was a lot of money back then, but the provisions that they added in 2005 increased the annual amounts that it goes up to. It's actually 7% for the license fee plus an additional cost of living adjustment that's based on the actual cost of living, which has averaged around 2% since then. So we're cumulative. The total amount is about, it's been going up about 9% a year. So you can imagine, since it's going up for 2005, even if it was reasonable then, it's really difficult now, and it keeps going up, and we have another 3 years in the lease. It goes until 2020. So that's even the scarier part, and we just absolutely cannot afford that. Part of the problem, too, is that if you remember in 9/11, all the antennas were destroyed on the World Trade Center, and so antenna space was kind of at a premium, and broadcasters were scrambling to get space anywhere they could, and so it was kind of easy, I suppose, for Empire State Building to decide to maybe increase the payments. We don't know exactly why they did it, but all we knew is the annual increases that they started charging would go up when the lease was renewed in 2005. And so we're basically just asking to let us out of the rest of the lease and waive the legal fees and interest and attorney's fees that they've been charging. We've been paying $12,000 a month for the last 3 years, which is about the market rate. And we think that's a fair amount, but we just mostly are asking for them to sit down with us and negotiate and try to work out something fair.
WBAI did sign that agreement 12 years ago, despite the fact that, as you say, the Empire State Building appeared to be rent gouging based upon the disaster of 2011.
Yes, that's what sure appears to be. And of course, there's no direct proof that it was because of 9/11, but we know that there was a big demand for antenna space anywhere in New York and Manhattan, in that area, because of all the antennas destroyed on the World Trade Center. And of course, now we have the new Freedom Towers available, and a lot of TV stations have moved there. But FM and TV antenna stations were all looking for space after 9/11. You know, we paid actually about $3.7 million since the lease was renewed in 2005. So it's not like we haven't been paying anything. They've made a lot of money off of us. And so I think they were telling some of the elected officials, we get feedback from one of them, they were telling them that we had not paid a penny since 2005, and that's completely untrue. We have not been paying what the lease calls for, and actually back in 2014, 3 years ago, and the following year, the general manager of WBAI met with them, with the Empire State Building people, several times to try to work out changes to the lease, and was told each time that their management would get back with them, and they were thinking about it, but we never really got a response.
It's a rather impressive list of elected officials that have supported WBAI, the public advocate, the comptroller of New York, lots of state legislators and city council members. What kind of impact has that kind of assemblage had in disputes like this before, or has there never been such a dispute as this before?
Well, I've never seen a dispute like this before, and I've never seen so many elected officials signing on to something, and we're still getting additional ones. I don't have them in writing yet, but additional people are getting interested. It's been hard to reach people because of the July 4th holiday, and a lot of people are on vacation and that sort of thing. But there's a lot of people that really care very much about Pacifica and WBAI, and you know, we've been standing up for the rights of people that don't have political influence for a long time, and we've been standing up for civil rights and workers' rights and the poor and people in prison and all kinds of people that really don't get representation much on the other broadcast media. And I think a lot of people do appreciate that, including some of our elected officials. So we appreciate that support. And we're basically asking them to encourage the Empire State Building people to basically just negotiate with us, be fair, let's work out a fair settlement.
The Empire State Building says you owe them about $50,000 per month. You've been paying about $12,000 per month for the last 3 years. What's their argument in terms of the tenant being able to decide what the rent should be?
Well, they just say it's in the lease that was signed in 2005. And I must say, it's actually, I don't believe it was ever approved by WBAI. The lease was signed by a former interim executive director, somebody like me, back in 2005, who hadn't been there in place very long. And he's deceased now, so I can't really talk to him. But it appears that he was probably felt he had no choice other than to sign the contract because there wasn't really any other reasonable place to go to other than that. And we'd been there on the Empire State Building, as you mentioned, since 1965. So it was a logical thing to do, to stay there. But it's really hard. And if the cost of living had actually, and the inflation rate had been 9% a year or something, then that might have been a reasonable increase, but it hasn't been anything like that. We've been supposed to be paying about four times the rate of inflation since the lease was signed. So it's really not reasonable. And I'm hopeful that they will negotiate, especially since some of the elected officials are encouraging them also. Hope they'll negotiate and work out something that's affordable, but we don't know yet.
And what's the position of the Pacifica Foundation, which owns other stations in California and Houston, Texas?
It's going to put a strain on all of the stations, the whole foundation, because they were all one legal entity. And if somebody sues one station, it's essentially all of us. And our finances are already rather tenuous because of, you know, listenership has been dropping some. Donations have not been as much as we would like. You know, public radio in general has been hurting some. But I'll tell you, this year especially, I mean, there's more need for Pacifica and for WBI than ever. I mean, I've never seen anything like the attacks on the media, all the media, and I guess especially independent media, is what's coming out of Washington right now. And I mean, just assaults on the Constitution and on people's rights and immigrants' rights and just it's like everything. And just throwing the Constitution out the window, it seems to be the trend. And I think that some of the other stations are afraid to challenge that as much as WBAI and Pacifica are doing.
Well, we've seen evidence of support from elected officials, most of whom aren't as left as your listenership. What should your listeners be doing in defense of WBAI?
We're asking listeners just to, you know, politely contact their elected officials and ask them to, assuming they're in New York, and ask them to, in turn, contact the Empire State Building people. The Empire State Building is actually owned by Empire State Realty Trust now, and we're asking people to contact their elected officials, though, and work through them. And make sure they understand that it's important to them and to the community. WBI has been serving the community of New York and that surrounding areas for decades. We need more. It'd be helpful to have more elected officials to sign on to the letters and to do what they can do to help. And I want to remind everybody, listeners can go to WBAI.org, and there's more information there on how to get involved.
And what's the timeline on this legal saga? What's next?
Well, we're asking the judge to hold a settlement conference with the Empire State Building people and with Pacifica, and it's up to the judge's schedule to set that. It will probably be, we hope, sometime in the last half of July. It could potentially be later, but we'd like to get this behind us, but there's not a definite date yet. And there's nothing going to be decided until the judge decides to put it on his calendar.
And that's it
for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.